Hello and welcome to the official podcast for Matt's Movie Reviews. I am your host, Matthew Perkovic. Today, reviews of Journey 2, The Mysterious Island and Young Adult. I'll play my interview with Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy director Thomas Alfredson, and I'll end the show with my top 5 actors turned director. To find Matt's Movie Reviews at Twitter, please type in at Matt's Movie Rev. You can also find me at Facebook to do so. Please head over to the website www.mattsmoviereviews.net, and you can also find the link to the Matt's Movie Reviews YouTube channel and also our RSS links. So, coming up now is my review of Journey 2, The Mysterious Island.
We need someone to take us to an island located here.
That's the deadliest part of the ocean.
There is no island there.
Ooh, baby, easy peasy. Let's go.
Oh! That's my security system.
I'd rather take the Titanic.
Here's the deal. A few nights ago, a radio signal got sent out from these coordinates. It could be the mysterious island that Jules Verne wrote about.
You think you're going to travel halfway around the world and meet up with some lunatic who's messing around on a ham radio?
It's not some lunatic. It's my grandfather.
He's been looking for Mysterious Island for over half of his life.
Where are we?
Hey, I think I found a way off the beach!
Ladies and gentlemen, I give you
the Mysterious Island.
This is heaven. I'm checking in.
This is amazing.
Well, don't just stand there.
Grandpa!
Who's up for an adventure?
Journey 2, The Mysterious Island is the sequel to Journey to the Center of the Earth. That it was a film that restarted the whole 3D trend that is now infesting modern blockbusters. Now, while that film was ahead of the curve, so to speak, Journey 2 lags behind better films that uses the combination of CGI, Lost World Adventure, and 3D to greater effect. Josh Hutcherson reprises his role of Sean Anderson. He is a rebellious teen who drags his easy-to-please stepdad Hank, played by Dwayne Johnson, on an adventure to find a mysterious island which Jules Verne wrote about in his books. On their way, they employ the services of a shoddy airline pilot, played by Lewis Guzman, and his hot daughter, played by Vanessa Hudgens, to fly into the most dangerous part of the Pacific Ocean, where, naturally in most of these films, a freak storm forces them to crash into the island of their destination. It is when we're introduced to this mysterious island of the title that Journey 2 reveals its greatest strength, its visual extravagance. CGI effects provides a lush environment of bright green vegetation, you have a volcano that erupts gold, and there's also this bizarro attitude to size where large animals such as elephants are no bigger than the puppy dogs, and bugs and lizards and the likes are the size of Mack trucks. It also has an effect on its cast. In our world, Michael Caine, who plays Josh Hutcherson's grandfather, is a well-respected actor who chooses his projects well. On The Mysterious Island, Caine is an overacting disgrace to his alternate self, and the rest of the cast don't fare any better. Josh Hutcherson only seems to be around because of his connection to the first movie. Vanessa Hudgens plays nothing more than eye candy as she runs around in a tank top and short shorts, and poor Lewis Guzman, who is so good in classics such as Carlito's Way and Boogie Nights, is left with all the jokes but receives no laughs. Hope is placed on Dwayne Johnson to do a Fast Five and elevate the material, yet the powers of the Mysterious Island prove to be too strong even for The Rock, who becomes a goofy mess playing a ukulele and flexing his chest muscles at any given moment. It's left to the visual effects to dazzle us, and admittedly, director Brad Payton, along with his effects team, do a pretty good backdrop in regards to the whole green screen work. And there's also a chase sequence involving giant bees that has moments of suspense and looks good on the big screen. Yet to reiterate, such imagery has been done before in much better films. Journey 2 needed more than visual spectacle to work. Perhaps if there is a Journey 3, they could think of utilising humour, suspense and characters worth caring about. And if you want to check out my interview with Journey 2, The Mysterious Island, stars Josh Hutcherson and Vanessa Hudgens, please head over to my YouTube channel. Welcome back to the official podcast for Matt's Movie Reviews. I am your host, Matthew Pekovic. To find Matt's Movie Reviews at Twitter, please type in at Matt's Movie Rev. To find links to our Facebook and YouTube pages, please head over to the website www.mattsmoviereviews.net, and there you can also find our subscription RSS links. Please subscribe to the site. Coming up now is my review of Young Adult.
Welcome to Hampton Inn. Do you have a reservation?
No.
Is that a dog in your bag?
Nope.
We actually allow small pets with a cleaning deposit.
Good, because I have a small dog in my vehicle.
What are you doing back in Mercury? Or you move back, or?
Of course not. Gross.
Psychotic prom queen bitch.
Here's the deal. Buddy Slade and I are meant to be together, and I'm here to get him back.
I'm pretty sure he's married with a kid on the way.
No, kid's here. I'm cool with it. I mean, I've got baggage too.
I would keep all of this to yourself. I would find a therapist.
That new baby of his is just darling.
Have you seen it? Up close?
As far as morally ambiguous movies go, none come close in recent times to Young Adult, the latest collaboration between Juno director Jason Reitman and screenwriter Diablo Cody. But then again, that shouldn't be a surprise, since Cody has never been a stickler for right-wrong dramatics. Her Oscar-winning script for Juno took a skewed approach to teen pregnancy, and Young Adult is just as bent in its story of a bitter young adult fiction novelist named Mavis Grady, played here by Charlize Theron. She returns to her hometown to reclaim her high school love, Buddy, played by Patrick Wilson. The problem is, Buddy is married and has a bouncing baby boy. Yet such qualms will not stand in Mavis's way. She views his domestic bliss as domestic hell and will do anything to save him. Cue many cringeworthy moments that are equally funny and disturbing. Mavis is one wicked, wicked woman, yet like all monsters, Cody and Reitman make sure that there is a tragedy-ridden backstory to explain this disturbing, albeit entertaining, sociopathic behaviour. It's a great character piece which Theron suits to very well, with that dour mug down pat and those piercing eyes burning a hole through the screen. Other performances also impress. Patton Oswalt, a stand-up comedian who also did the voice in Ratatouille. He delivers a funny and moving supporting turn as the voice of reason to Mavis's delusions. And Patrick Wilson is his usual solid self as the befuddled target of Mavis's obsession. It makes sense that Reitman would direct a young adult, despite the obvious Diablo Cody connection. Four films into his career, and it's clear what type of material Reitman is drawn to. Specifically, character works, focusing on an entertaining yet flawed individual told within the comedy/drama genre. It's also clear that the typical rules of the character arc don't impress Reitman one bit, with every one of his subjects, whether it be Aaron Eckhart's Big Tobacco representative in Thank You for Smoking, or George Clooney's career Terminator in Up in the Air, spit in the face of redemption. Cody is only happy to oblige Reitman, with her Mavis stuck within the maturity level of a teenager and the foresight to boot. The decision to do away with any notion of resolution in this film is both a refreshing and frustrating one, yet such feelings are to be expected when dealing with a young adult mentality of one, Diablo Cody.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the official podcast for Matt's Movie Reviews. I am your host, Matthew Pekovic. To find Matt's Movie Reviews at Twitter, please type in at Matt's Movie Rev. To find Matt's Movie Reviews at Facebook and YouTube, please go to the website www.mattsmoviereviews.net. And while you're also there, why don't you subscribe to the website with our new RSS links. I'd like to thank all of the people who have donated to the website over the past week. I thank you very much. All donations are appreciated. Matt's Movie Reviews is a free website to all. There will be no subscription. There will be no paywall. But if you like what you see, you like what you read, and like what you hear, and you wish to donate, there are PayPal, tabs on the website. If you don't feel like giving up your hard earned cash in that way, please click on a Google ad, or you can alternatively pay for a product from Amazon via one of our Amazon links. All donations are appreciated. Coming up now is my interview with Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy director Thomas Alfredson. Now, as a general rule of thumb, acclaimed directors from non-English speaking countries have found a transition to English speaking films to be difficult and laborious. To use a few current examples, and I do apologize profusely if I get these pronunciations incorrect. Have a look at director Florian Henkel van Donnersmarck. He directed the excellent film The Lives of Others, but his Hollywood debut was the little scene movie The Tourist, which Ricky Gervais repeatedly makes fun of at his Golden Globe appearances. Another example is the director Oliver Hirschenbiegel. He directed the excellent film Downfall, but his Hollywood debut was The Invasion. That was his English-speaking debut, The Invasion, which starred Nicole Kim and Daniel Craig, which plagued with production problems from the start and turned out to be a rather mediocre movie. However, Thomas Alfredson doesn't seem to have any problems with his first English movie. He directed the acclaimed Moody vampire movie Let the Right One In, and here he has assembled an all-star cast of British talent for his adaptation of John le Carré's Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. It's a film set during the Cold War, and it stars Gary Oldman as George Smiley, a semi-retired spy who is asked to investigate whether a Serbian agent has infiltrated MI6. The film also co-stars Colin Firth, Tom Hardy, John Hurt, Mark Strong, and a host of other premier British talent. It's also proven itself to be one of the best films of 2011 and showcases a director able to weave tightly woven suspense and character depth into an engrossing movie experience. If you want to read more about the film, there is my review available at the website. So I spoke to Thomas Alfredson back in late December, and we talked about the making of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, working with an actor as great as Gary Oldman and his career thus far. So here is the interview. Enjoy. Well, congratulations with the film.
Thank you.
I enjoyed it very much. I guess my first question is, after the success of Let the Right One In, you must have received a ton of different directing offers. What made you want to choose Tinker Tailor as your follow-up film?
It's hard to answer, but it's right as you describe. It was Let the Right One In was my first international success. And I was a little paralyzed by that, and I didn't know what to do for my next film. And so I read scripts for almost 2 years before I decided to go with this. But I tried to read books and scripts with my body rather than with my brain.
Mm-hmm.
and it's a very physical thing. If you see images, and if you cry or laugh or get upset or something when you read it, it's something that you react physically on. And I thought this was when I first heard about that, this was the project was on the market, so to say. I was very excited when I heard about it, and I saw the TV series a long time ago in the mid 70s on Swedish television, and I remember it very vividly. even though I was too young to understand it. And then in my early 20s, I read the Carlin trilogy, and I was a big fan of it. So the books and the world has always attracted me.
I read that John le Carré gave you a piece of advice, which was not to shoot the book or remake the miniseries, but make this material your own. With that in mind, what type of rules or boundaries did you give yourself to make sure that this version of Tinker Tailor would be different from others, but still faithful to the source material?
Well, you know, it's actually when you think of it, there are so many ways to look upon the same thing, depending on where you stand in the room. If you and I were interrogated tomorrow about our phone call we have now, and if I were to describe the feeling, I would describe a sunny day in London in a cozy hotel sofa, and it's noon, and you would describe the same thing totally different. But we have shared this moment in two very different positions, and it's the same when you read something, you get very different images, and I think shooting a book is not for the author; it's for a possible audience. And John le Carré said, like, it's meaningless if you do the book, because the book already exists. And if you make a crappy film, the book will still be good. So he really encouraged us to be personal with it and have a different view. And I think it's impossible to do 360 pages like this book is. You have to sort of cut out a fillet or pick a side. And I think we have tried to do a very emotional take on this, on what the personal costs were for the soldiers of the Cold War, rather than trying to be philosophical about the East-West political situation, or the details of the Cold War, or the factors behind it. So we decided to do something about the human costs.
It's funny you say that, because my initial reaction to the film was that I felt really sorry for these men and what they had to go through. Were you also very sympathetic to these characters?
Yes, you have to love your characters even if they do things you don't sympathize with. And I suppose their lives must have been awful in many ways. And someone told me a story, I think it was John le Carré, that some of these spies, they were actually decorated, and they were invited to a small ceremony in Buckingham Palace, and the Queen would give them a medal, and they could wear it for 10 minutes, and someone would take the medal and put it away in a cupboard because it was secret, the whole thing, and the silence and the secrecy that these people had to live in must have been horrifying in many ways, and and they must be a lot of them must be still alive, walking the streets all around us, but we don't know what they've done or what they've experienced, or they're not allowed to, discuss it with anyone. Mm. So it must have been a very strange
You've assembled a really terrific cast in this movie. Were you amazed with the number of really quality actors who wanted to star in this movie?
I was, because but to be honest, it was quite easy.
Mm.
The everyone we asked wanted to participate, and I think 90% of the cast is our first choices, and the other 10% couldn't be in because of practical reasons. But everyone wanted to be in this project, and it was fantastic to have the opportunity to work with the finest actors that there is in this country, and it was easy as well to direct it, because it's easy to direct great talents. It's just to let them do what they're good at. So it was in that way very joyful.
The first person cast in the movie was Gary Oldman. He's known more for his ability to play really extroverted characters. What made you think that he'll be the perfect fit for someone as introverted as George Smiley?
Well, I was looking for an actor that could, that wasn't, you wouldn't, how do you say, associate with the kind of character he plays in this film.
Mm-hmm.
So he should be not connected to other Smiley-esque types. And if you see what Gary's done through the years, it's very, very, very different portraits of people. And I thought it would be... he's the perfect guy for the part, because he's also a very different choice than, let's say, Alec Guinness. And that was good, because Alec Guinness's portrait of Smiley is so famous and well done, so we really needed to come up with something different for this interpretation.
I read that Gary said that he really wants to play Smiley again. Could you foresee you two having another crack in another Le Carre novel? Perhaps maybe something like Smiley's Affair?
We have discussed it, and it would be great to do that. And we just have to find the right timing for it. And John Le Carre has said that he have an idea how to combine the Honorary Schoolboy and Smiley's People into one film adaptation, and I would be happy to participate. And I think the rest of the creative team behind this film are more than interested to do it.
It was interesting to read that you actually worked on a lot of comedic projects before Let the Right One In. Can you see yourself return to comedy in the future?
Yes, I try to. No, as I mentioned to you before, it's not like I think genres is something for marketing people.
Mm-hmm.
It's to label things if they're tragic or funny or scary or dramatic. It's not for me to decide, and I try to do as different things as possible, and as hard things as possible for me to do, and. So if it would be something that you makes you laugh or cry, it doesn't matter really.
You come from a movie family with your father, an actor and director. Was directing something you always envisioned something that you will do?
Yes, and my brother too. He's actually done the part two and part three of the Dragon Tattoo series in the Swedish versions.
Mm-hmm.
We're three directors in the family, and I think it's I think maybe it's I'm sort of, my father was doing films he started in the early 60s, so I was born into this, and all my summer holidays I spent on different movie sets, so I had the opportunity to learn a lot in just watching and participating, and I never considered myself doing anything else really. But because it has been such a important part of my family life.
Final question. I'd like to know, what are your favorite espionage movies?
Oh. Would you consider that film, what's it called, with the about the Watergate scandal, an espionage film? What's that film?
Or the President's Men?
Yeah.
I think it's pretty close to it. It's definitely a conspiracy movie.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic film.
Yep.
But I never watch films before I do films for the purpose of doing films. Mm-hmm. I try to be as much as possible a normal movie goer. Yep. So I think too many filmmakers today, they watch other films and refer to other films when they make films.
Yep.
Themselves. So, and I think that's a little pointless to do. And I'd rather, you know, inspire myself from painters or composers or writers than other filmmakers.
And what's an example of some type of inspiration that you had for this film? No, I don't know.
It's spelled H-A-M-M-E-R, Hammer.
Yep.
S-H-O-I.
Okay.
Toy, I think, yeah. And if you look at his... He's considered as one of the greatest painters in Danish history, and they're quite spooky, and it's always very lonely characters in those images, and they're very smiley-esque if you look at them.
Yep.
And I think there are hundreds if you would look at on internet, Wilhelm Hammershøi.
I'll definitely do that. Yeah. Excellent. Well, I thank you very much for your taking time out today. And
thank you.
And once again, congratulations with the film. It's one of the best films I've seen this year, and I look forward to seeing more films from you.
Thank you very much. It was very nice talking to you.
Likewise. Bye.
Take care now.
Bye. Thank you. Welcome back to the official podcast for Matt's Movie Reviews. I'm your host, Matthew Pekovic. I hope you did enjoy my interview with Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy director Thomas Alfredson. I highly recommend the film to everyone. It's one of my favorite films of the year, of last year. And with that in mind, let me just say that at the end of this week, the annual MMR Awards will be up. That's the Matt's Movie Review Awards, where I hand out awards for best film, best actor, worst film, worst actor. It was a big hit last year and sure to be again this year. I'm currently working on my final nominations and winners, and as soon as it goes up, you all will know about it. Until then, it's top five time. So this week, I'm going to count down my top five actors turned director. Last year in 2011, there were a lot of great actors who put on their director's hat on and directed their own films. I'm talking about Vera Farmiga in her great film Higher Ground, Ralph Fiennes in the Shakespearean adaptation of Coriolanus, and how about Angelina Jolie directing the Bosnian set war film In the Land of Honey. So with all of these directors turning director, I thought I'd count down my top five favorite actors turned director. Coming in at number five is Woody Allen. The man is an institution upon himself. He's directed and starred in some of the most iconic romantic comedies of our times, with the odd departure into darker territory here and there. Films such as Annie Hall, Manhattan, and Hannah and Her Sisters shows how Allen cornered the adult, as in mature, comedy spectrum that influences filmmakers such as Wes Anderson and Noah Baumbach. Acting-wise, he's always played an erotic mess while on the screen, but lately he's opted to appear less in front of the lens and has instead directed all-star ensembles to moderately successful results, with clunkers such as Cassandra's Dream, followed by near masterpieces such as Midnight in Paris. And even at the age of 77, Allen shows no signs of slowing down, with another film called Nero Fiddle in post-production, and I look forward to seeing that movie. And number four is Clint Eastwood. He's got two directing Oscars under his belt, so he is the actor-director on this list with the most awards. He also has the patchiest filmography, with a string of great films always followed by another string of less impressive features. His directorial debut was Play Misty for Me, a psychological thriller which scared audiences half to death, with its tale of an obsessed woman played by Jessica Walter, which some people might know from the TV show Arrested Development, who stalks a disc jockey played by Clint Eastwood. And the movie proved that the Dirty Harry star had the skills behind the camera. Since then, he's had a diverse range of films from High Plains Drifter to Honky Tonk Man and Bird, which kept his directing credibility high, yet it will be the anti-Western Unforgiven which stunned critics and won Eastwood the Oscar for Best Director and Best Film, and that will be a feat he will repeat with his boxing drama Million Dollar Baby. And even though there were stinkers such as Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil and Hereafter that crept up time and again, Eastwood will continue to impress behind the lens with films such as Letters from Iwo Jima and Gran Torino. The man's notorious for the speed which he shoots his movies, usually using one take to shoot a scene, and because of that, there is no doubt that Eastwood will continue to pump out films at a persistent pace. Number three is Sean Penn. He's one of the finest actors of any generation, and he's also proved himself to be one hell of a director, able to draw career-defining performances from his actors. His directorial debut was The Indian Runner, and it told the Cain and Abel-esque story of two brothers at odds with each other. The film introduced the acting talents of Viggo Mortensen and David Morse, who both turned in astounding performances. Same goes with Jack Nicholson in Penn's two next films, The Crossing Guard and The Pledge, and those were movies which saw Nicholson step outside of his usual Jack persona and deliver turns worthy of the highest praise. And that is Penn's greatest gift as a director. It's his ability to have his actors reach beyond their abilities and give us something unique and raw. And that goes to his next film, Into the Wild. That was the biography on doomed adventurer Chris McCandless, who is portrayed by Emil Hirsch in a breathtaking turn. That Hirsch has not been able to deliver another performance remotely close to it proves Penn's prowess as an actor's director of the highest caliber. Penn's next film is The Comedian, which is due to star Robert De Niro. Maybe Penn will be able to inspire old Bobby to tap into his long missing acting talent and turn in a long-awaited good performance. Number two is Mel Gibson. The American-born, Australian-American director. He's directed four films, each impeccably crafted and filled with Gibson's passionate zeal for his subjects. Little is ever said of his directorial debut, the underrated and deeply sentimental The Man Without a Face, which starred Gibson as a disfigured teacher who agrees to tutor a lonely young boy, played by Nick Stahl. Yet such selective amnesia to that film makes sense when delving into the rest of Gibson's directing career. Braveheart, that was a tour de force performance, in front and behind the lens for Gibson. It's a story of the Scottish revolutionary William Wallace and his battle against English rule, and it saw Gibson bring back the epic battle movie with a vengeance, with its battle cry rousing theatrics and action violence impressing many a critic and scoring Gibson Oscar wins for Best Director and Best Film. It will be his next film which saw Gibson hit artistic and box office highs, yet reach critical lows. The Passion of the Christ was a film which no one believed would have any impact. It depicted the final 24 hours of Jesus Christ's life, and the film was subtitled with the characters speaking in dead languages, Latin and Aramaic, and also saw Gibson pour $25 million of his own dough to cover production costs because no studio wanted to back a Jesus picture. The results as well as the reaction to the film was staggering. Gibson reinvigorated the biblical film with awe-inspiring artistry and unflinching, some say grotesque, violence. And while some unfairly criticized The Passion of the Christ as anti-Semitic, many of whom did not even watch the film, Gibson's bold and passionate depiction of Jesus' crucifixion was a massive hit. In fact, it's the highest grossing R-rated film of all time. Unfortunately, off-screen scandal clouded the release of Gibson's next film, Apocalypto. It was a Mayan set thriller that took its cue from The Passion in its use of dead languages and hard violence. Yet the critical response was actually much kinder to this film, with many praising Gibson's eye for period detail and action filmmaking. Once again, unfortunately, Gibson's personal life was marred his creative side, with a proposed Viking film set to star Leonardo DiCaprio put on the shelf after another scandal. With that controversy now subsiding, hopefully Gibson can get this production back on track, because a filmmaker that is that good deserves not to be on the sidelines. And at number one in my top 10 actors turned directors is Charlie Chaplin. Now, the word genius is one I seldom use, but in the case of Charlie Chaplin, it is an accurate description. He was a director of many short films, but it would be the feature-length classic The Kid that saw Chaplin truly show his artistic brilliance as a performer and director. He was the first to mix the comedy and drama genres in the story of how Chaplin's signature character, called the Tramp, became the guardian of an orphan boy, played by Jackie Coogan. Next came another comedy classic in The Gold Rush, where the Tramp character goes in search for gold, yet in his pursuit for wealth, he will find love instead. Chaplin declared The Gold Rush as the film for which he would like to be remembered, and it's easy to see why, with its blending of hilarious physical comedy and heartbreaking romance. And it was also the film that featured Chaplin's infamous bread roll dance. That's when he put the forks in the bread rolls and made a little dance with them. Chaplin continued to make silent movies as the talkies came into fashion. He beat the odds and topped the box office with City Lights. That's a film many declare to be Chaplin's finest work, as he weaves tender romance, socially relevant drama and physical comedy into the heartfelt story of the Tramp character falling in love with a blind girl. Modern times once again saw Chaplin defy the popularity of talkies and meld social commentary with his unique brand of dramedy, as the Tramp character takes on the modern industrialized world, which Chaplin blamed for the poor physical conditions of the Great Depression. Very controversial movie there. Yet controversial compared nothing to his next film. He finally yielded to the power of the talking picture and upped his political commentary with The Great Dictator. That was a satire on Nazi Germany, where Chaplin played a Nazi leader named Adenoid Hinkle, who was a parody of Adolf Hitler, and he also played an unnamed Jewish barber who had more than a slight resemblance to the Tramp character. The film was both controversial and popular, and would go down in history as Chaplin's last great masterpiece. The following 7 years saw Chaplin embroiled in personal and political scandal before he released his next film, the dark comedy Monsieur Verdot. But even by Dean Chaplin's legacy was written in stone, his innovative prowess both in front and behind the lens was phenomenal. Equally infamous was his perfectionist attitude towards his work, with the director demanding up to 100 takes to finally get a single sequence right due to his improvisational style, with Chaplin never working off a completed script, and also his obsessive nature. Although he was an immensely controversial figure off the screen, Chaplin will always be remembered first and foremost for his films, and because of that, there will be never anyone quite like him. So that was my top five favorite actors turned directors. That completes the show for today. I hope you did enjoy it. For more Matt's Movie Reviews, please head over to the website www.mattsmoviereviews.net. And don't forget to tune in at the end of this week for the nominees and winners of the annual MMR Awards. Until then, take care.